Welcome to Top Shelf at the Merrick Library with your host, Carol Ann Tack.
Welcome to episode 42 of Top Shelf at Merrick Library. I'm your host, Carol Ann Tack, and thanks as always, listeners, for joining me. Okay, so let's talk about a genre. Let's talk about a genre that includes books like The Sisters Brothers by Patrick DeWitt or The Witch Waitree by Elizabeth Crook, who was a guest on the Top Shelf podcast. And then you've got News of the World and Simon the Fiddler, both of those by Paulette Giles. Cormac McCarthy, Blood Meridian, All the Pretty Horses. These are all knock-your-socks-off Westerns. Some of them are turn of the century. They're all just amazing pieces of literature, and for me, they're perfect. Most of these sit firmly in historical fiction and not say what we would traditionally think of historical fiction, which is why I'm so open to this Western piece of history, because it's our country that we're talking about, and I love reading this particular time period in historical fiction as it relates to the United States. To that incredible list of titles, I have to tell you, I am absolutely thrilled to add this 5-star debut called All Things Left Wild by today's guest, James Wade. James, I really, really cannot thank you enough for coming today.
Hey, I'm so happy to be here. Thank you for having me. And at this point, after that intro, I'm happy to let you keep going. I'm not even sure I need to say anything. That was wonderful. Thank you so much.
Welcome. It is my pleasure. You made it really easy. So I do want to give the listeners some background into who James Wade is. You are an award-winning fiction author with 20 short stories. Now, all of my listeners know I just have such a thing for short stories, but your short stories are published in some of the best literary journals and magazines. The novel we're talking about today, All Things Left Wild, was released in June of 2020. So with all of that, James, can you tell us what All Things Left Wild is about?
Well, I'm certainly more of a writer than a speaker, so I don't know that I can give the perfect delivery, but I'll shoot for the stars here. All Things Left Wild is a combination of a coming of age for one young man and a midlife crisis for another man when a botched robbery goes wrong and leaves a young boy accidentally murdered. So Caleb Bentley, our main character, he is talked into a very ill-advised robbery attempt by his older brother. And during that robbery attempt, they accidentally kill the only son of a wealthy rancher named Randall Dawson. And that kind of touches off our whole story, which is the Bentley brothers on the run from the Arizona Territory through New Mexico, into Mexico, and then into Texas, pursued by Randall Dawson. And the shakeup there is that Randall Dawson, despite being a wealthy rancher, is a very bookish, kind of more of the East Coast intellectual tilt than he is a trailsman or a cowboy, or for that matter, even someone who knows how to survive out in the wild. And so the chapters alternate between the Bentley brothers heading east and Randall Dawson on their trail.
I read on your website, which is jameswadewriter.com, that you were a journalist for about 5 years. What was it like turning to fiction? Was there something that made you try your hand at it?
Yes, ma'am. So I was a journalist in East Texas for 5 or 6 years, and then segued into politics here in Austin, Texas, where I live, which is the capital of Texas. And I worked at the Capitol for a few years. I worked for some lobby firms. I always have to say the good lobbyists, right? So I lobbied for things like water conservation, public education funding, all the good lobbyists. We hung out on one side of the Capitol and the bad lobbyists hung out on the other. but I was in the political realm for a while. And while there is certainly a lot of good that can be done there, it was also just so soul-sucking and draining. And I think no matter your political persuasion, we can all agree that the current climate is just very nasty. And so I was tired of all that. And my wife, she came to me and said, look, you're not happy doing this. What is it that you really want to do? And I said, well, you know, I've always wanted to write fiction. And it just so happened the Texas Observer, a great magazine here in Texas, was having a short fiction contest. And it was one of those things. I'd never taken a fiction writing class in college or anything like that. Still haven't. And so I thought, well, I don't want to try this and put a lot of time and resource into it if I'm not any good. And so I said, I'll write one short story. I'll submit it to this contest and I'll see what kind of feedback I get. And I was lucky enough to be an honorable mention choice for that contest. I wasn't a finalist. I wasn't a winner. And in fact, the finalists and winners have gone on to have great publishing careers since then. But just being an honorable mention story in that contest really kind of gave me the confidence and boosted that resolve to go, okay, maybe I should try to learn a little more about writing and get into that. And so that was the one moment, the one story that really shot me into fiction.
When you were writing the short story, if it were me that got honorable mention, that would be a win for sure.
Oh, absolutely. Yes.
So that's a huge thing. The short story you chose, is it something that you had in your mind to write, or sort of how did that flow for you?
So I was at the doctor's office. I was in the waiting room and it was taking forever. And I had my laptop with me from work. I had gone from the office to the doctor's office. And I basically, this is a strange story I've never told before, but I basically willed myself to, people talk about, oh, I just start writing and I don't have an outline. I literally wrote the sentence, there's a story in my head. And that became the first sentence of the first short story that I ever published, and the short story that went on to be honorable mention. And I actually, like the total word nerd that I am, I got that tattooed on my forearm. And I'm sad that the listeners can't see this, but you can see this. It says, there's a story in my head. And in hindsight, it seems a little braggadocious because people are like, oh, you're a writer. There's a story in my head. And so I have to explain, it was actually the first line of the first short story I ever wrote. And I kind of willed that story into existence a little bit. But it was a story called Eligible, about a grounds crew worker for a high school who witnesses a very bad thing happen between a teacher and a student. And it's kind of up to him to decide what way he wants to handle the situation. And I was very happy to get that honorable mention. In fact, Stephen Graham Jones, who is finally getting the love he deserves this summer for The Only Good Indians, because he's published a ton of great books, but I feel like this is the first one that's really catching hold and kind of sweeping the nation, so to speak, this summer. But he was the guest judge that year. And so to have him choose mine out of the hundreds, if not thousands, of entries that those folks got was a big boost. I mean, as writers, we are very, we're very sensitive and we're very fragile and we need that positive reinforcement. So that was a good foot to start on for me.
Also, I feel like maybe we owed a debt of gratitude to the doctor for keeping you.
Yeah, right.
I don't know. I feel like you should send him a copy if it wasn't for me waiting in your office.
He's actually in my acknowledgments of all things worthwhile.
He is.
He's been great. And aside from that one time where he made me wait a long time, he's been wonderful and instrumental in a million ways. Because I feel like you've got to have a good relationship with your doctor,
sure,
right?
Do.
Like that's a.
So now we've just sort of given the green light to doctors everywhere to keep everybody waiting.
That's right.
Just to see if someone's got a novel or a short story.
That's
in
right.
There.
Yes, ma'am. Oh, well, at least we've given the folks that are waiting something to try their own hand at, right?
That's
you
right.
Can make the waiting room fun.
Give it a shot and see what happens. The inspiration for this novel particularly, All Things Left Wild, did this book come out of the short stories that you had been writing? Tell me where that comes from. Did you have it in the back
sure.
of your mind?
I actually didn't. It's the more I tell these stories, the more I realize that maybe I am just one of those writers who has that lightning strike inspiration, even though I don't preach that. Like when I talk to writers who are just starting out, I always preach discipline. It's sitting down at the desk and working your way through stuff. But for the short story Eligible, and then also for All Things Left Wild, it really was a spur of the moment thing that happened. With All Things Left Wild, my wife and I, and the backstory here is that while I was doing all the politics, my wife was working in real estate here in Austin, which is one of the crazier, more hectic real estate markets in the country. And we both were just so burned out. Me in the political realm, my wife doing the real estate stuff. And we basically just decided over a bottle of wine one night, we decided, you know what, we've got to make a change here. And so we actually donated about 80% of our possessions. We put a few of our records and like an old couch into a storage closet, basically. And then we bought a travel trailer and we hit the road and went around to all the national parks, to a lot of the national forests, free camped on Bureau of Land Management land, and just tried to, it sounds hokey, but tried to find ourselves, right? Like find what was our purpose? Because for me, it wasn't going to be politics. For her, it wasn't going to be real estate. And find an inner peace to where we could move forward and start a family, which we've since done, and know that we kind of know who we are and the things that make us happy, the things that are important to us. And during all this, we were camping in the New Mexico desert, just outside of Carlsbad, New Mexico, and we're on Bureau of Land Management land. So it's basically the only thing they use that for is maybe like some free range cattle, maybe some oil drilling. And neither of those were happening at the time that we were there. So it was this completely open landscape, just untouched by anything. We could barely get our trailer down the road because it hadn't been maintained in years. And I went on a walk one morning and I'm having my coffee and I'm looking out over this landscape. And I'd been in the practice and the habit of meditating a lot. And so I did a little meditation. And when I opened my eyes and looked out at this land, it was so barren and desolate and wild and untouched. And I thought about the fact that it had been an ocean hundreds of thousands of years ago. And I just thought of what all this land had seen. And it made me feel a little guilty for being there, right? I thought, God, why am I here? Almost like desecrating this uninhabited place. And what I realized was, you know, I looked at my footprints, my boot prints in the sand. And as I'm walking back to the camper, this huge dust storm blows up and I watch it literally before my eyes blow my boot prints away. And I go, oh, well, it's not like I was the first one here. Obviously, there have been people on this land before. There have been civilization, Native Americans, Spaniards, oilmen, ranchers, all these folks have lived on this very piece of our country. And yet their footprints aren't here, right? They've been blown away and this land is still left wild. And that's where I kind of got the idea for a novel is I wanted to take some folks and I went back to the camper right then and I wrote about two brothers who were caught in a dust storm. And it just kind of grew from there. I just wrote a few paragraphs about these guys. And as I kind of got into who they were and why they were there, that's where the backstory unfolded. And it all kind of went from there.
It's just kind of out there at that point.
And yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am. Absolutely.
That is felt by the reader because the reader is just absolutely pulled along in this page turner. You've created a novel. It's beautifully written. The characters are beautifully drawn. The scenery is very lush. It's stark. It's very hard, right? It reminds me of Paulette Giles, News of the World. There's like sand in your teeth kind of thing. But you've got this historical piece of it, which is just blows me away. And then you've got good versus evil and the blurred lines of good versus evil. Did you start thinking about writing this kind of book or were you more inclined to let that narrative take you?
It was a little of both, to be honest. Certainly the stuff about the blurred lines between good and evil, the kind of ever-evolving morality based on circumstance, it's something that I've preached 1,000 times. People get tired of talking about, but I just believe that so much of our lives are dictated by circumstance. Things we believe, the lives we lead, the opportunities we have. It's just one circumstance after another that is made possible by one choice after another. And it's not necessarily always our choices. A lot of our circumstances are dictated by not just the choices of those in power, but the choices of our family as it dates back generation. I mean, it's a very trippy thing kind of to take that, to pull on that ball of thread and realize that we got to where we are based on this long lineage of decisions, of trends, of outcomes, and in a lot of cases, complete luck. And so I like putting my characters in circumstances where their morality is tested a little bit. I like to take these characters that often seem sure of themselves. That's Randall Dawson. He really believes that he knows the difference between right and wrong. And you see throughout the course of the novel, as circumstances continue to change and things continue to happen to him, those lines get really blurry for him. And it really makes him question his whole identity, his whole existence. And that's what I want. And I want the reader to do that as well, you know, put themselves in those shoes and say, well, what would I do in this situation? Or what's a situation I've been in that's maybe similar to this where I've had a tough call to make? And so I've always wanted to write a book like that. And as for the narrative, I just kind of let it lead itself, you know, let the characters make their own decision and hope that it makes sense a little bit. Because I didn't always know what they were going to do.
That was my next question. Having said everything you just said, say, for example, Randall or even Shelby or Caleb, they kind of make these decisions because of circumstance. As you're writing, is there somebody who you thought, oh man, I really wish they wouldn't make that decision? Right? Because you're the armchair traveler at that point.
I'll tell you what, when you write a novel that is... This novel is so obviously, this doesn't spoil anything because from the beginning, it's so obvious that you have these two intersecting men, like these men, Randall and Caleb, they're destined to collide. it's a chase novel. It's a novel that builds to a conclusion. And what I'll say is that I, for the longest time, did not know what that conclusion would bring. I didn't know. And that's, as a reader, I can imagine, because as a writer, it was very tough because I fell in love with both these characters. You empathize with Randall, you see kind of what's happening in terms of his transition. And then you also really feel for Caleb because he's had such a troubled past and troubled history. And he, more than anyone, is put into situations where there really isn't a right choice. It's basically the lesser of two evils, or maybe the more prudent of two evils. And so you really are yearning for him to find some peace. And so, yeah, you've got there. Who's the bad guy in that case? So that's what I wanted readers to feel, because that's what I felt. And so, yeah, in terms of, did I ever wish they made different decisions? Absolutely. Absolutely.
What I am drawn to is the revenge tale. And in Elizabeth Crook's The Witch Way Tree, she sets readers on a path of revenge that makes for quite the page turner, again, right around the same time period. And the same thing happens here. And I'm fascinated by the way you blend that together with incredible, again, character development. Caleb is fully realized. So is his brother Shelby. And then you mentioned Randall. And of course, Charlotte. I mean, we just love her. She's smart. She's rational. She's stronger than all of the men in the novel. And they certainly think that they think a certain way, and she's got them all beat. And I really just fell in love with her. All of these characters are converging in a very specific time period. What made you choose that time period? Did you kind of have that in the back of your mind, or because it's really wild where all of this action takes place? This is America at its, it is very wild. And tell me about that.
Well, I always like to, again, kind of rely on circumstance, and oftentimes maybe circumstances that people don't think about. And so if I were to tell somebody, you know, I wrote a piece about America in 1910, then they're going to think about a much more civilized America, I think, than what the book shows, because we've got electricity, we've got all these established laws and practices of society. But at the time in the Southwest, Arizona is not a state yet. It's still a territory. New Mexico is not a state. It's still a territory. Southwest Texas might as well be its own territory. I mean, that's probably still true. But in Mexico, they're just touching off what's going to be basically a decade-long revolution. They've had simmering tension there political tension there for a long time. So you have this part of the country that's completely set apart via the lack of transportation infrastructure, the lack of cohesive law enforcement. You might have a sheriff in one community who is completely disconnected from someone just a few counties over. And so not everybody's working on the same page. So it becomes a little bit of a heyday for these low-level criminals and scammers and all this stuff, because you really can just move to another town, change your name, which is what the Bentley brothers hope to do. But I thought it was just kind of perfect, because it pits this very wild, very untamed part of America against a historical decade that a lot of folks would believe is much more proper, so to speak. And so I thought it would be. And again, this blends into Charlotte, which, by the way, yes, she's the best character. There's no question about it. When I started writing her, I wanted to write someone who was the complete opposite of Randall, since she was going to kind of be his scene partner, as it were. And Randall is not tough. He's very rich. He's privileged. He doesn't have a lot of real world experience. Charlotte, of course, is the complete opposite. She's a Black woman. She's had to endure so many hardships and fight tooth and nail just to get where she is. And my God, is she a badass, right?
She's amazing.
she's amazing. But I think you hit on it when you said that she's reasonable. That's something I wanted to show, kind of play with masculinity in that way, to where all the men, even the quote unquote good guys, they're making these decisions and they're often influenced by kind of like what it means to be a man. And those decisions usually lead to more trouble. Whereas Charlotte is the voice of reason. She's like, okay, look, I can kick everybody's ass, but I'm not always going to. Sometimes you have to be a little more logical than that.
Right. And she does at some point, she's like, listen, you guys got to fight your own battles here. I'm just, right. So, and after I read it, I was really trying to picture who would play her in the movie. So if anybody wants to know what I think, you can find out, but I'm not going to say it until you read the book, then people can ask me. It also reminds me of Taylor Brown has a book called Fallen Land that came out a couple of years ago, maybe 5 years by now, but it also speaks to this kind of anarchy that's happening in this time period. And I do hesitate to pigeonhole All Things Left Wild as a Western because I feel it will prejudice readers in some way. So to me, it's just historical fiction where, like you said, in the 1910s, we do think that everything is like New York City. It's being developed. Now, there's all these things mm-hmm. that are happening. We talked earlier that I love science fiction. So this particular time has a science fiction feel because it's something I can't really ever imagine. So when a writer produces it on the page, especially the way you do, I mean, I grew up in Brooklyn, New York, and the Southwest at the turn of the century is another galaxy to me. It is. It's another planet. So when I read this, it grounds me in that time period. So that's why when this book came out, I just kind of jumped at it. To go back to Charlotte, I love that the men in the story all pale in comparison to her because she's so strong. And every time she's on the page, even when she has no dialogue, you let the reader know that she's in the background. She's right. always there. So I don't know where she comes from for you. How does she must have been a very loud voice saying, listen, you're going to let these boys play around, but I need to be here too.
Well, I love reading novels or watching films where there's a character, it's not necessarily the main character, but you can spot them almost immediately and go, okay, that's the voice of reason, or that's the rational character. And oftentimes they are overruled or they're at some disadvantage. And in this case, I wanted these very flawed men to make this trek and basically kind of expose all the weaknesses that we as humans have, but also in particular that we as men have. And in order to do that, I mean, you kind of have to show the other side, right? And so in Charlotte for Randall, and then also in Sophia for Caleb, right. you have these women that are, they're tough and vitalist and all these things, but also they're just logical. And it goes back to how many wars have women started? How many, like, I just feel the world would be a better place if more women were in charge. And I wanted to kind of show that in this novel. And I started that with Sophia. And Charlotte was actually, she began as just a counter to Randall. But the more I developed her character out and her backstory, the more I was like, well, she's the best. She's the best one here. She's gone through basically all the same things that these boys have gone through. And yet she didn't lose her humanity. She didn't have a crisis of self or morality or any of that. She's still the all around good guy. Like you can pick and choose where Randall and Caleb made the right decision or the wrong decision or the moral decision. But she always, from the jump, made the right call. And even though she's not necessarily the one driving the train, she is always there and she's watching and observing these decisions being made. And she basically says, all right, this is what I would do. Oh, you're not going to listen? Okay, that's fine. I'm still here and I've still got your back, but I want you to know that you're doing something I advise against. But again, it speaks to her strength and her loyalty that she's able to still stick with Randall and stick with Tad and Pumpkin as they make this trek, because she feels like she has to be their protector. I think that can be frustrating, but you know, certainly for the women in my life, they've watched me make, whether it's my wife or my mother, they've watched me make terrible decision after terrible decision, but they don't abandon me because they're a lot stronger than me. And they know, okay, you know what? I'm going to advise him. If he doesn't listen, I'm just going to let him learn his lesson. And then I'll be there to basically pick him back up and carry him through. And again, I've said it in interviews. I've written about it in blogs. I wanted so desperately to relay the strength of women that I've known in my own life and put them on the page. And so I used Charlotte and Sophia to do that, but they're a mix of a ton of women that I've known, that I've been raised by. And yeah, I'm really happy with the way it turned out, because when I'm doing these podcasts, when I'm talking to readers, that question comes up a lot. It seems like the women are stronger than the men. It seems like masculinity, you know, you kind of take a few shots at it. And yes, the answer is yes. That's it. That was on purpose. That's entirely true. And I'm glad that it's conveying.
You've got Caleb, Shelby, Randall, Tadpole, Pumpkin, and of course, Grimes. They just leap off the page. I don't lose track of them. When you write all of these characters, is it hard for you to keep track of them? Do you have like a story arc for each one, like a post-it? This is what Grimes is going to do. And this is like, how do you keep track of that?
Basically, it starts with the narrative, starts with the story, and I know kind of the situations I want to put everybody in, and then I let the characters react based on just kind of the vision I have in my head of of what that character is. And sometimes that is, I think, once you get a sense of who Tadpole is, for example, you kind of know how he's going to react to things because he's a child and he's a pretty simple character and he's pretty consistent. It also gives you a chance to watch Randall change, because in the beginning, you might be able to kind of anticipate how he's going to react, but then he starts to react a little differently as the novel goes along. And so it's a great way to build character, but also to get a sense of how the character's changing when they do something that's a little unexpected or a little out of character, no pun intended. But for Grimes, he was maybe the most fun to write because you really didn't know what to expect, because his character wasn't really defined. And again, that was a little bit on purpose, but he was so brilliant and yet so evil. And he had this sense of justice that was very twisted. And yet I think a lot of readers will kind of see some of what he's saying and go, well, I do kind of agree with that part of it, you know, but maybe not the way that he's getting there. And so he was he's one of the more complex characters. And so his decisions were always fun because I would think that I knew what he was going to do. And then I'm like, well, I don't know. What if he did this? I think in his twisted mind, that actually might make sense as well. And so to kind of parcel that out and go down a few different paths with that was fun to play with. And certainly he made decisions that then changed later in the editing process as I went back and said, well, you know, this might serve the narrative a little more. Because again, that's always what I try to keep first is the story. And it doesn't always work out that way because we're humans and we're flawed. And I want my characters to, you know, reflect that. I want people to know that the characters are fully formed so that they can anticipate what decisions they're going to make, while also having those surprises in there that go, oh, I didn't see that coming. Well, that's kind of life, right? I mean, a lot of people make decisions that we don't see coming and we have to kind of react to that. And it gives the other characters a chance to react to the surprise decision or surprise path that we're going down.
I went through this book and underlined all of these sentences. I made one of them my Sunday sentence, which is a Twitter thing. And if folks, if you don't know what Sunday sentence is, go to Twitter and just look up the hashtag Sunday sentence. But I have to share it because I still keep reading it and I still go back to it and I still recite it, if I may, if you don't mind, that I just...
By all means.
And I'll try to get rid of my Brooklyn accent when I read it. They gave what blessings they may and hoped for one thing or another and hoped for peace and hoped for rain. If all the hopes of all the world were drowned in a great sea, still the dark sky would brighten. When you hit a sentence like that, do you know how that's going to land? The book is philosophical, it's spiritual, but it's still this story. Do you know that sentence is going to land like that? Do you say, oh, honey, listen, this is what I wrote. What do you think? She's like, for goodness sake, go to sleep.
Certainly, those, for goodness sake, go to sleep. Yeah, that's about right. My wife calls it book brain when I like kind of stumble out of the office and just have like a zombie look on my face. I'm just murmuring words to myself. You hope, obviously, that it's going to land, or down south, we call it hit. You hope it's going to hit, but you never know. And it's just tough because I always heard that as a debut novelist, you're going to try to put way too much in your book. And I always heard that. And I always kept that in the back of my mind. And I still fell victim to that because there's just, you think you're never going to be able to write another manuscript. And so you want everything you think in this book. And that doesn't always serve the story and serve the narrative. And so when you can add those more philosophical touches in there and the more lyrical prose, and it does serve the tone of the story and serve the setting and the landscape, that's a win-win because you're able to put that stuff in there without losing sight of the narrative and without losing the reader. Because I would love to sit around and read those sentences all day, an entire book full of them. I mean, that's what a lot of McCarthy, Blood Meridian is one of the greatest books ever written, and it doesn't really have a plot. It's considered one of the great American novels, and I don't disagree. I think McCarthy's the best that we've ever had, but oftentimes he will lose the plot in this just amazing philosophical prose. And I love that stuff, but that's not for everybody. And you want, Blackstone has put a lot of faith in me, and they've done a great job marketing this book. And so you want to create something that all readers can digest and enjoy. And if it makes them think, yes, of course, great. You want to do that too. And that sentence that you just read, that's a very nihilistic view of the universe, right? That it doesn't really matter what we do or hope or think, that the world is still going to turn. The dark sky is going to brighten. Things will be better. Things will be worse. I don't know if I could ever write an entire manuscript that completely encompasses those feelings. And so what you want to do is kind of sneak that in a little bit. You want to sneak it in a little bit. And I was able to do that in some places and in some places not. My editors did a great job of saying, hey, you got a little too philosophical here. You got a little too out in the weeds. And I think that's important, because as much as I want to be egotistical and write down everything, you know, that I think and believe, we have to serve the narrative. I mean, at the end of the day, that is our job as writers and as storytellers, is to have a coherent story moving forward and not lose people. And so I'm just thankful to the folks around me that helped kind of shape the book and soften a little bit of the edges of it.
And I think that sentence in particular really gives the reader pause and says, hold on to your hat, folks, because stuff is going down. I'm grateful to Blackstone for taking the pieces that maybe didn't fit this place and could go into, say, another something else you might be creating. We'll get to that.
Absolutely.
Fingers crossed. There is one scene, and there are so many, but there's one scene that really set me back on my back foot. And it's during one of the bigger shootouts in the book. And there are two or three Rangers. I think it's two. Maybe there's three of them. They're sort of discussing what they think has happened. And it's after the action has occurred. And they're just sort of discussing what they think has happened. And they're discussing it in such a removed way, which kind of goes back to that sentence that I just read. Because for me, I'm thinking, I want to shake them both and say, you have any idea what just happened? This is big stuff. But you gave us this perspective. What made you throw that in there? I mean, it's perfect. It's wonderful. Because
look, if I was there, I would hug you. Oh. Because thank you for noticing that and bringing it up. That is actually, I'm not one of those writers or one of those artists that's like, oh, don't touch my work. You know, it's perfect the way it is. I deferred like almost wholesale to my editor, Peggy Hagman. She is amazing. And I'm working with her right now on my second novel. She's wonderful. And so I loved every suggestion she made. But I think it's chapter 36 is the only chapter in the book that is not told from the perspective of Caleb or Randall. And it's told from the perspective of two nameless Texas Rangers who have come in the aftermath of a very climatic shootout that actually happened off page. And that was another thing, is I didn't want to desensitize the readers to the violence that's going on. And so I had one of the turning points happen off page and then be retold by these Rangers. And they are telling it very removed. And that was purposeful, because what I wanted to remind readers of is the same thing that I remind myself of all the time, is we get very invested in our own stories. We think that the world is turning for us and what we want or need is very important to everyone, but it's not. And because everybody is trying to just do the best they can and make it in their own stories. And so these Rangers are coming in the aftermath of something that's very important to the characters in the book. It's very important to the readers who are invested at this point. It was very important to me as a writer, you know, who had gotten that far, because this happens a little later in the book. But they're so removed from it because they're just doing their job. They just woke up that day. It was just another day for them. And they are able to kind of talk a little more logically about some of the stuff that happened, about some of the characters, without knowing the history, without being caught up in the emotion. I really wanted to fight to leave that in there. That's the only thing I kind of put my foot down on, is, hey, I know that this is kind of chops up the narrative a little bit, but I really want to leave it because I want readers to, in that moment, like you said, be kind of on your back foot. You're taken out of the story and you realize, wow, the whole world in this novel is turning without the main characters, without everything that's happening. And it's just a gentle reminder. It's only a couple pages, but it's a gentle reminder that as much as we think that the universe revolves around us, we are all part of a much bigger, much greater whole. And again, it goes back to, like you said, that sentence. Yes, we want to do our best. I think you can have it both ways. I think you can do your best. And I think you can try to influence positive change. But at the end of the day, know that the world is still going to turn and there are still things beyond your control. And a lot of folks look at that and say that's a very pessimistic view. But I actually think it's optimistic in a way that like takes the pressure off. If we don't get the job that we want, or if we make a mistake in a relationship with our friend or something like that, it's okay. It's going to be all right. Just do your best to better it. But we're not ruining the world. We're not ruining the universe. The universe doesn't really care about us. So we just do the best we can to get by. And yeah, I just think there's a certain freedom in that. Let's put it that way.
I mean, it takes the ego right out. That scene.
Yes, ma'am. That's it.
Completely gone. So that's what totally took me back. And it was very hard to explain that to my entire family. I'm like, you don't understand. This is what's happening. And they're sort of like, Mom, oh my gosh, you know, cut it out already. Go back, go to sleep.
Yeah, go to sleep. Exactly.
It was just so surprising. And it was a welcome surprise. And further to what you just said about that, the sentence being pessimistic or nihilistic, for me, it is optimistic, because I do see that still the dark sky will brighten. So
yes, ma'am.
That's how I interpreted my Sunday sentence. And I thought, well, there's hope. It's hopeful.
Yes. So, yes. To the listeners, I did preface this entire conversation by saying I'm a better writer than I am a speaker. So if you really want to know, to get a sense of what we're talking about, you'll have to read the book.
Yes.
I'm doing probably a terrible job of rambling here, but that is the hardest thing to convey, is how the duality of trying to say that, like, oh, it doesn't really matter, but still there's hope, and do your best and live a fulfilled life and try to help everyone and be selfless. So it really is about taking the ego out. You hit the nail on the head, which doesn't surprise me at this point, because it really seems like you, quote unquote, got it. You got what the book was about. But it is. It's about removing the ego from what we do, because I think that frees us to serve our fellow man a lot more, to serve our maybe higher, less judgmental self, and try to aspire to that. And by the way, I don't do that. I know what to say. I know what to work towards, but obviously we keep making mistakes. And that's the whole point, is we always will make mistakes, and we have to forgive ourselves, and we have to keep moving forward, and the dark sky will brighten.
So hooray, hooray. That's why I can't wait for people to read this. And I do push it on the Happy Half Hour show that I do on Facebook, because it's important that a book like this does not get lost in the sauce of everything else that's going on. You're with Blackstone, as you mentioned, we mentioned earlier. And I do want to say a special shout out to Lauren Maturo for helping get this interview off the ground. And she's just amazing. And so is Blackstone. And you let out a pretty big spoiler before, and I don't normally like to ask this question, but I am just going to go all in. You said you were writing, I assume you're still with Blackstone, and you're writing something.
Yes, ma'am.
You're writing something else.
So we actually have a release date for my second novel called River Sing Out, and it will be released from Blackstone on June 8th, 2021, hopefully at a time when the world has halfway righted itself. But yes, ma'am, we're in the editing process with that right now. And we'll have, I think, an ARC hopefully by this December. But I'm so excited about it. If All Things Left Wild was kind of like me trying to find my footing as a writer, I mean, it was the first full manuscript I've ever written. I asked my wife if it would be strange if I gave a review of my own book online and just said, pretty decent first effort, but saw some places where you can make improvements. And so that's, I feel like the second book is even stronger. I'm even more excited about it. But yeah, it's called River Sing Out, and it's actually a modern tale in East Texas, which is where I'm from. And so I kind of flipped the script and went from West Texas historical to modern day East Texas, and tried to keep though kind of that same philosophical, gritty, very real. And yeah, I'm really looking forward to it. And you mentioned it before about how awesome Lauren and Blackstone have been. And I would be remiss if I didn't say that we just released a debut novel in the middle of a global pandemic, in the middle of a very warranted movement for social justice. I have a 9-week-old daughter here, my first baby. And so I have that added joy, but also responsibility. And so through all that, Blackstone was able to be accommodating and just go with the flow and make the adjustments necessary to help us get our best foot forward out with All Things Left Wild. They do that for all their authors. So grateful. And they hook me up with people like you, where we get to have these great conversations. And maybe this is one of the silver linings of the pandemic, is that I'm able to talk to folks in New York or Arizona or wherever, and reach folks that maybe I wouldn't have been able to otherwise.
We talked about it earlier. I saw you speak. It was either a Day of Dialogue, and it was a Library Journal sponsored event. I think you had mentioned that.
Yes, ma'am. I think that's what it was.
And it was a historical fiction panel. And what I loved was that this book was on that historical fiction panel.
Yes,
that is exactly where it belongs. So I will reiterate that when I book talk it to everybody that will listen to me and not tell me to go back to bed. listeners who may want to find you and see if you're going to be doing any other interviews, where can they find you? Are you on social media? Where can they look you up?
Yes, ma'am. At James Wade Ryder is my Instagram handle. That's my favorite because I don't have to say a lot. I just post pictures of other people's books and a lot of great photos of what my wife and I are up to. We travel around the country, so you get a lot of cool landscape shots. But jameswaderyder.com is my website, and I do blogs on writing and tips on writing. And we're going to have some classes on there, I think, starting pretty soon. And then you can also follow on Twitter or Facebook, James Wade Ryder. And yeah, and I love when people reach out. I had a guy reach out the other day who said that he also writes short stories and was starting to transition to long form novels. And I asked him to send me a short story, and he was just kind of like, what? Really? So many folks, when I was first starting out, were so gracious and so kind to me to help me along and be a good member of the literary community that I feel like I kind of have to pay that forward. And so I love talking to other writers. I love talking to readers. So reach out to me. Don't hesitate. Let me know if you're reading All Things Left Wild, you want to talk about it. I'm game for that too. Whatever you guys want. Look, we're all quarantined. They tell me it's 110 degrees in Texas right now, but I have no idea because I haven't left my house in like 2 months. So.
And it's pretty warm in New York too, I have to tell you, if the frizz is any indication. I can't thank you enough for joining me, but I do want to ask you, the short stories that you've got, where can people find those? Are they on the website?
I believe, and I'll have to talk to my webmaster, aka my wife, I believe that the stories themselves are not on there, but the publications that they're in are listed. But so I'm trying to think of the ones that are free, right? So I think there's BartlebySnopes.com has some free short stories. But yeah, they're all listed on the website, all the different publications. The ones that are free, you know, you can just click on it from there. But it's interesting because the short stories, I mean, there are some non-literary, just completely genre horror stories. There are some stories that kind of hint at the type of writing in All Things Left Wild, but they really are all over the place because I was just, the short stories were a way to find my voice, right? And so I had some comedic pieces on there that were in some comedy magazines like Intrinsic magazine. And so there was a lot of toying around with what type of writer I wanted to be before we ever got to All Things Left Wild. And so I've had a lot of folks reach out and go, you know, I've read some of your short stories and it does not sound like All Things Left Wild. And that's me crawling as a writer and trying to learn how to walk. So,
did you say horror? Because I am a huge, I buy all the horror and science fiction for the library. So my horror collection is just, my personal collection is just incredible. Now I need, you have my email or get it to Lauren and get me that. I need to find that horror story because that.
I would be happy to send that to you. That's you know, with Stephen Graham Jones, who writes a lot of horror.
Oh my gosh.
When he said nice things about my first story, as a young writer, you just kind of latch on to anything. And so I go, oh, well, he writes horror. Maybe I should write some horror. And so I did a few, you know, scary short stories and we're fortunate enough to have them published. And that's the other thing is when you can get your work out there, that's always such a, you just have to be so grateful of that. That's another thing I tell young writers is just be kind and know that for everything you see published, that piece probably has 10 rejections from other publishers or from other journals or magazines. And it's just kind of the way it is. And so I was very fortunate to have those 20 stories published. But I have another 20 stories that never will be published. You know what I mean? That's just the way it is. You just have to write and hope for the best and hope that nice people like you bring you on their podcast so that you can tell everybody to read your book.
Well, I'm certainly not going to be the last because this is, once people get wind of this, it's a big book. And I am so thrilled that you said yes and that you're here. I really can't thank you
enough.
You're
too kind, ma'am. I'm happy as a bird with a French fry.
Yes. There you go. I can't thank you enough for joining me today on Merrick Library's Top Shelf. Listeners, thank you so much for joining us today. You are not going to be disappointed in this book. I don't think I've steered any of you wrong yet. The authors that have been on with me, I'm just an evangelist for everything they write, and I am thrilled to add All Things Left Wild by James Wade to that group of novels. So I just want to remind everybody to follow Top Shelf at Merrick Library on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, and wherever you find most podcasts. For the latest and the greatest at the Merrick Library, check out our website at merricklibrary.org. Special thanks to Merrick Library Director Dan Chusmere and the Merrick Library Board of Directors for getting us off the ground and onto the airwaves. Until the next time, remember to keep us on your top shelf. And thanks again, James, so much for being here. I am thrilled.
Thank you so much for having me, ma'am. It was a true pleasure to talk to you. I had a lot of fun, and now you got me fired up about writing again.
Awesome. And thanks to your doctor, too, by the way.